broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to another episode of The Investor Exchange. I'm your host today, Louis Van Copenhagen, with my growly voice. Yeah. Joining me is Brett Dickinson.
Hey, Louis, you sound a bit different.
Thank you, and Joel Hewish.
Yeah, good morning, Louis. You've been burning the candle at both ends, hey, mate?
I have. Or, you know, it could be that things are different after the operation.
Was it a success? I thought it might have been too many Christmas parties.
Just a joke. No operations and no parties, unfortunately.
You haven't earned it then.
Just a plain old cold.
Damn it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, look, it's been another wonderful week in the world. Joel, I'm going to kick it straight to you for what's happening.
Lots happening as always. I'm a bit caught up with what is happening over in France at the moment with these yellow jacket or yellow vest protests that are going on. Are you guys,
I'm
familiar with what's happening over there.
No. Look, I've only seen the headline, but you know what's the implication there?
Well, it apparently everyone is for the prevention of global warming, except if they have to pay for it. Yeah. So there is a fuel price increase in France that is being proposed. It's now been scrapped on the back of these protests. But the French government were proposing to introduce a further fuel price increase by slapping on an additional tax. And many of the workers have said enough is enough. We don't want to... the cost of living in France and particularly in Paris is too much already.
It is expensive.
And we can't afford this. And this tax, we are going to fight against it. And so it's been interesting because much of the reason as to why this was going to be brought in was because it was supposed to disincentivize people to go and buy fuel. Run cars and, try and lower the levels of, toxic emissions from cars. However... I think the French civilians have said, hey,
revolted.
Yeah, come on, enough is enough.
Yeah.
And also it's made worse by the fact that there was a fair bit of discussion around that a lot of the tax revenue that was going to be raised from this tax wasn't actually going to go into
any
things that
change.
Was going to reduce climate change.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of flexibility there. The French are great at doing this sort of stuff.
Good at a revolution.
I don't understand why they would introduce that if they didn't have an alternative. Like, people still need to have transport. They need to get around.
Yeah.
Well, the skeptic in me suggests that much of this, carbon emissions tax and greenhouse gas tax is really just another means for...
revenue raising.
...big government to raise revenue, to, keep themselves and the establishment in power and to, feed their own self-interest rather than actually delivering the outcomes that they suggest.
The climate change facade over the top of it.
Yeah, it's a cloak. It's a cloak. And I think that the French have sort of woken up to that. Now, that's at the moment, in France, they're suggesting that some of the reports that I've heard is that it's about $6 a gallon for fuel in France for petrol.
You mean 6 euros or $6?
No, it's equivalent of six US dollars.
Right.
Whereas in many parts in the United States, you can buy fuel in the $2 range.
Yeah.
That's a gallon at this current point in time.
Three times.
Wow.
So it's almost three times the cost of fuel in France is what it is in some parts of the United States. Now, obviously, here in Australia, I think we're probably paying close to around about $2.50, would it be, a gallon if you converted litres into gallons? Probably even more.
Probably four litres for every gallon.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we'd be paying, around $5 or $6 Aussie dollars.
Yeah, we're closer to France than the US.
So we'd be around the four-ish US dollars a gallon.
And we've got more and more of the big US style cars, the SUVs and that, than probably France does too.
Probably. And Joel, you are quite a skeptic.
I am a
government's
skeptic.
Trying to fill their coffers with no interest for the public. I do agree that governments do want to fill their coffers, but the way they do it can influence public behaviour. Good on them for trying to do something, but I think they might have misjudged their population's reaction, especially when the next country is so close by. Like any country in Europe, you drive over the border, you're talking, you know, five countries on France's border, excuse my ignorance in the geography, but you just drive over the border, might only be a few Ks away, fill up your car. Yeah, of course, there's going to be some inequities there.
Yeah, I am. I'm naturally skeptical of large governments. I am a, you know, it's just... sort of
Mr. Capitalist.
Well, you know, I do believe that, you know, there's so much inefficiency with government that, and they've never ever really proved themselves to be fantastic allocators of that cash flow.
I agree. They're not very good at spending it.
Yeah.
But at least they can raise it in a way that influences public behavior to maybe use low emission sources of energy. That would be nice.
Was it Kerry Packer that had that famous saying when he was being questioned about tax evasion or tax avoidance?
Yeah, anyone who doesn't do whatever they can to stop paying taxes needs to get their head read.
Correct. Yeah, that's right.
And didn't it go on to say, because I don't like the way you use it, you don't manage it well.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Something
that's
along
right.
those lines.
Yep. So along those lines, if they made the way people pay taxes linked to behaviour, such as consuming lots of energy... Well, then, if you want to pay less tax, well, then you stop emitting so much carbon and pay less tax that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that's perhaps the theory behind why they were bringing this in. However, you know, there was certainly enough skepticism amongst the French population to suggest that...
Well, they fucked it up, haven't they?
Yeah, they fucked it.
If your population reacts that way, you've had a balls up.
Yep. Yeah, well, I mean, I think... And this is indicative of perhaps where Europe is at the moment. You know, the French... population are probably very similar to, you know, the sentiment you're seeing in Greece and in Italy and in many other parts around Europe, where they haven't seen wages grow. They've seen an economy that's been in pretty much the doghouse for the best part of 11 years or so. And the cost of living continues to go up, but yet, you know, jobs are still scarce and wages increases have been almost, you know, non-existent in Europe. And this is what you end up getting when you try and squeeze them too hard.
Yeah.
You end up getting revolutions, unfortunately, or revolts, certainly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Absolutely. Look, what's the feed-in impact then on markets?
I think it probably, by and large, has very little to do with you know, financial markets. I just note that, you know, more than anything, it's probably just a bit of a
political climate.
Yeah,
a risk.
It's indicative of the sort of political climate that we're in at the moment. Mm. The average person feels as though they're getting screwed. The ones that have got the wealth seem to be getting wealthier, and the political elites and the you know, the one percenters, you know, tend to be the ones that are being seen as taking advantage of the ordinary guy.
Yeah. Well, I guess there's only one solution. Be rich.
Exactly. All right. Well, look, on a more serious note, we're also getting to the point where we're getting to a Brexit vote now. I don't know if you guys have been...
This has been going for a while.
It has.
So, coming to crunch time, though.
Yeah, crunch time. So next Wednesday, the British Parliament vote on whether or not they're going to ratify the agreement between... ratify the agreement that Theresa May's government has...
put together.
In principle... signed off with the EU.
Negotiated, inverted commas.
Yeah, and by all looks of current trends, it appears as though that's going to fail. So what are the potential outcomes? Well, firstly, they could go ahead with the exit if it fails. The UK could go ahead with the exit if it fails and rely on the World Trade Organization to help the UK implement trade arrangements with the EU. But that would be a hard Brexit option. And I think, you know, some of the things that are sort of coming out of this, if you listen to the rhetoric, obviously the EU have a vested interest in making sure that the UK suffer some pain. I mean, they don't want this to be a nice, easy exit. Yeah.
They don't want others getting the same idea.
Yeah, but if you listen to what the different constituents are perhaps saying, it's very clear that the EU want the UK to go into a recession. Okay, they probably don't want them to go into a depression, which would probably be the case if they went into a hard Brexit. But they certainly want them to feel pain. And the way that the UK are looking at this is the UK is trying to obviously stave off any sort of pain and any sort of recession that might arise. So, you know, it's going to be interesting because there's a lot of vested interests here. But as it currently looks at the moment, okay, what happens if this vote fails? Well, first of all, the UK could rely on the World Trade Organization to help the UK develop trade arrangements with the EU. That would put the UK in a very weak position. You'd probably almost instantly see the pound sell off dramatically.
Because they'd be exiting the EU with no agreement in place.
Nothing. Instantly, what does that mean? Tariffs, all sorts of, you know, types of penalties.
Border controls,
all that sort of
stuff. Immigration controls.
So you'd almost certainly have an instant, you know, cut-off in the way that commerce was being done between those two major...
And be at the mercy of the others to...
Correct. Yep. Now, secondly, the UK could unilaterally decide to withdraw its notice to exit under Article 50 of the EU Treaty and thereby stopping the Brexit process altogether. And maybe, you know, revisit it later on down the track. Now, this would buy some time because remember the Brexit vote was non-binding. Okay, so this referendum was not a compulsory referendum.
Yes.
This was put to the public to vote on, but they were not bound to actually follow the Brexit process.
34% voted for Brexit, 32% voted against Brexit.
Yeah.
A lot of abstains.
And 34% just didn't vote at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this would buy time, obviously, and things would continue on as the status quo, and there'd be no hard Brexit, but there'd be no resolution, and this would be an ongoing saga that will probably continue on for some time. You'll probably end up getting some political disharmony in the UK off the back of that because it was obviously voted for, and if the people aren't being listened to, then there could be all sorts of political ramifications in the UK itself. Thirdly, if the withdrawal agreement legislation is defeated, the opposition would most likely move for a vote of no confidence in the government. So that would generally probably trigger a general election in the UK, which would almost certainly see Theresa May's Tory party kicked out. Now, from my understanding, I think there would also need to be some agreement in regards to the Tories agreeing to some sort of vote of no confidence, because obviously the Tories are in power. So in order for a vote of no confidence to get up, you would need some of the Labour Party as well as some of the Tories, well, most of the Labour Party or all the Labour Party plus some of the Tories to agree to a vote of no confidence. Now, that's not likely to happen because the Tories are unlikely to vote for something that is going to kick them out of power.
That's right. They'd see the loss of the election coming.
Yeah.
And then lastly, if the MPs reject the withdrawal agreement on offer and elect against a general election, the Prime Minister could call a second referendum on the Brexit issue. Now, as it currently stands, the legal precedence for this is a little bit uncertain, and what the ramifications would be following that and whether or not it could actually get up and actually take place, a second referendum, is a little bit unclear because it's never really been tested, and I don't think there's any legislation that really outlines what the process would be if that was the pathway. So what impact is this happening as investors? Well, it's not really actually influencing the financial markets at all, to be honest with you. I mean, what's really driving the volatility is really much around, you know, the US Federal Reserve and the US-China trade war.
But, you mean you've got the entire government of the UK in disarray, fighting with the entire government of the EU, and that's causing little or no impact on financial markets, but then one person's words, the head of the Federal Reserve, he's having huge influence over financial markets.
Absolutely, so we're seeing, you know, when Jerome Powell came out with his announcement last week, US stocks are up 2.83% on the back of, you know, Jerome Powell saying, hey, we're going to be a little bit more concerted and a little bit more conservative about how we go about raising rates. We're going to be a bit more data dependent. Then we had, you know, reports over the weekend that the US and China had come to an agreement to at least stop the war and stop the escalation of the tariffs.
You mean the trade war? Not an actual war.
Yeah, exactly.
Calm down, listeners. Trade war.
And markets rallied again off the back of that. And then you had some peanut that came out about 2 days after that and said, yeah, we're still going to raise interest rates by three times next year, who's not even, you know, I don't even think he's...
Not an authority anyway.
Yeah, I mean, why is he even talking?
He's just a man in the street.
And sure enough, you know, we have the market sell off again and give back all of those gains. you know, what you're clearly seeing at the moment is that markets are not being dictated at all by what's happening with Brexit. It's really being driven by what's going on with the Federal Reserve and the China-US relations at the moment.
Wow, okay.
Even though this is it's noteworthy. Yeah.
Well, it just shows the size of the UK's economy. and financial market.
Exactly.
In relation to the US's economy and size of their financial market. Yeah. Not only is their physical economy bigger in terms of gross domestic product and the number of companies that are there, but just the amount of money that is in the markets in the USA, just because it is a magnet for the rest of the world to come in. Mm. It's not just the USA's population, but it's the whole global market putting their money into the US markets.
Because
that's where the action is.
That's where the action is. I mean, the US stock market is worth more than half of the total value of global equity markets.
Yeah.
You know, whatever happens in the US, you know,
it moves the world.
It moves the world, exactly.
Yeah. Imagine instead of the UK leaving the EU, imagine if it was Texas leaving the USA. That would be...
That'd be massive.
Of impact.
Yeah.
Or California leaving the USA.
Absolutely. Well, California is the sixth largest economy in the world.
It is.
Wow.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that would be huge.
That would be massive.
Yeah.
Interesting. Very interesting, Joel. Thank you for that rundown. Always interesting to hear how these massive headline events can have actually little or no impact on financial markets.
Yeah.
Very interesting. We're going to go to a break now. We'll be back with more from Brett Dickinson after this break. Ooh.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Welcome back, listeners. We're going to kick it over to Brett Dickinson now. Brett, what have you been listening to this week?
Well, listening and reading, Louis. So I'd like to discuss a little bit of clickbait, opinions, statistics. So a whole bunch of things that I've seen this week that I thought were worthy of discussion. Here's a headline for you. Australian property prices will crash 50% in 2019.
Is that Harry Dent?
Gotta love that one.
Is that Harry
Dent?
Okay. Is it Stephen Keane?
You're getting close. When you hear who it's from, you'd actually go, what? Why are they saying that? It's actually from Saxo Bank.
Right, okay.
Who?
But Saxo. Yeah.
Saxo.
Okay.
Okay, but...
fill me in, Joel. Who's Saxo Bank?
Well, we trade with Saxo.
I know we do, but our listeners don't know that.
Okay. Very
Is Saxo Bank some weird foreign tier 50 lender, or
no,
are they
they're
a
very
major
large,
international player?
Very large Dutch bank, Dutch-based bank. Danish bank. Mm. That we use to trade global markets here at United Global Capital.
So they're not dummies.
No.
Big international players.
No, that's right.
Thank you.
But Brett, come on.
We'll get to the point. So, well, like a lot of those big institutions, they have their research and their reporting that they do on a regular basis, but this is their annual tongue-in-cheek outrageous predictions.
Oh, okay.
So it's not really what they think, but it does make a really good headline. I thought it was worth mentioning that that's the kind of thing, if you just read headlines, you could be influenced by.
There you go.
Yeah. But the other thing, statistic-wise, the last week, clearance rates are really in severe decline. If we look at where they are currently now, clearance rates, obviously, measurement of auction activity and how many properties are selling at auction. Now, typically in Australia, that's really two major cities, Sydney and Melbourne, that are strong with auctions. So it's not a complete measure because, you know, a lot of the other capital cities don't run auction campaigns to the same level.
They favour the private sale
private
method.
Treaties, yeah. Mm-hmm. But if we have a look at the weekly clearance rate for the combined capital cities, you know, as put forward by CoreLogic, so they're taking it across all of the capitals and bundling it together. It hit a peak with the clearance rate across the nation at around 80% in early 2015.
Right.
Okay. It stayed pretty steady in the sort of 70 to 80% bandwidth all the way through until early 2017, but the trend's been pretty downward ever since.
Right.
To where we're currently in the low 40s. Typical methodology around clearance rates to talk about the impact on the market is it a balanced market where supply and demand is in balance, is in around the sort of low 60s. Mm. So when it's above 60%, you'd say that it's a seller's market, the demand's really high. When it's below 60%, it's a buyer's market where there's, you know, there's less buyers than there are sellers. So for it to be as low as 42-odd%, so they're saying that Melbourne's at 43%, and we're the biggest auction market in the country. We've always got, you know, probably about 20% higher than Sydney, and Sydney's probably, you know, about 80% in front of the other cities. Mm. So for the Melbourne market to be that low shows that it's there's definitely a lot of weakness in the market. But of course, we know the reasons why. And a lot of it is because of the lack of a, well, the major two things that have had this impact over that timeline of declining clearance rates has been the offshore investors not being able to come into the market. And of course, the credit limits that have been put on.
That's right.
And so I saw some other interesting stats here around the credit as well. And now I know we haven't been a big fan of AMP over our journey here on the podcast, but they do have some smart people in there. I quite like sometimes what their economist Shane Oliver has to say. It's mm-hmm. it's well considered. And he's actually said that he believes the next move from the RBA will actually be downwards.
Down,
really?
Yeah. So for a long time, you know, everyone's been predicting that the next rate move would be up, you yep. know, with the cycle will change and interest rates will increase.
Yep.
But he's actually said that with the way the economy is trending and growth is likely to be stuck sort of in that 2.5 to 3% for the year ahead, he sort of sees a bundle of issues that will see the next rate cut or the next rate movement being actually a cut. So he says, given the combination of falling house prices, tightening credit conditions, constrained growth, which will keep wages growth weak and inflation below target, they're now changing their view from anticipating rates to be on hold until the second half of 2020 to now seeing the next move being a rate cut.
And when do they think that the rate cut might likely occur?
Well, they don't actually say when.
Okay.
They just sort of say that the next move is more than likely downwards.
Yeah, gotcha. Mm. Gotcha.
I think there would still be a fair bit of data to change because we would start hearing it from the Reserve Bank meeting minutes and such
yep.
before it actually happens.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting that one of the major economists, most prominent economists in Australia, Shane Oliver, is now predicting this.
Mm. Mm. Yep.
Very interesting.
Yeah. And what look, one other bit of data that I saw I thought was worth reviewing is a review of the 2018 year for the big three cities on the eastern seaboard, so Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane's property markets.
Right.
So statistically, from CoreLogic, Sydney's dwelling values have dropped 8.1% November to November.
November 17. To November. Okay, yep. That's a pretty healthy correction.
Yeah, it is a correction. Yep. Yeah,
healthy correction.
And they've seen that a lot of that's happened. So whilst they're saying the wider market is weakening, they're continuing to see settlement valuations not meeting off the plan purchase prices. So a lot of it's in the new stock coming onto the
right.
market,
okay.
not meeting valuation. And they said that, you know, from the peak in July and August of last year, they've already had some of the submarkets seeing values coming back. So overall, they're saying that Sydney is a declining market
mm.
as they sort of try to wind down 2018. Moving on to Melbourne, still a decline, not quite as severe as Sydney, but average dwelling values have fallen by 5.8%.
Okay.
So a lot of that's been the concerns around an oversupply in the apartment market, and that's led to declines in pricing, mainly around the inner suburbs, the high-density areas.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Interestingly, though, some of the outer areas, such as Miquelon, Craigieburn, Wollert, have actually seen some growth in pricing over the same period.
Mm. From new stock.
New stock, yeah, so new land releases. So as an example, the median house price in Miquelon, which is sort of out towards the airport there, has gone from $520,000 to
$540,000.
Oh, okay. So I guess the takeaway from a lot of this data is that, you know, there'll still be opportunities. The overall property market is in decline based on all the statistics, but, you know, as we've always said, markets within markets, if you know what you're doing, you can find opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and that's what people forget about the property market is it's not a whole market. It is that market within markets.
Yeah.
That you mention. So it's not a reason to stay on the sidelines. It just means you can't go without doing your homework and your research like maybe people thought they could.
Mm. And
people have thought if you just buy a property, well, then it will go up over time. Yeah. But yeah. it's not necessarily the case.
No.
And if you look at the long-term trend as well. Over any 10-year period, which is a decent investment time frame, you're going to have areas that show little or no growth, and you're going to have areas that show significant growth. Yeah. And that's really what you should be aiming for, mm-hmm. not the year-to-year fluctuations. But there's all the analytics that need to go into it in order to make a good investment decision.
Yep, most definitely.
And we've repeatedly said if you're buying property for investment purposes, it's a long-term horizon, 10 years plus.
Yep.
You're not trying to time it because you obviously, you know, entrance and exit costs of property are high, so you need to be in it for the long term. Mm. So, and the main reason, you're going to be in it for the long term, the main thing you have to be on top of is making sure that you've got your finances in order so you can hold it for the long term. You're not putting yourself under too much financial stress to maintain or service any debt you're taking on.
Yep. Which is why I start to get nervous when someone says, I want to buy a property in such and such location because things are going off there right now. I'm like, oh, are they?
Yeah.
So you're telling me the price has already moved, and now you're going to buy in.
It's too late.
But you've got that short-term horizon, not the long-term investment horizon.
Yeah.
Always concerning.
Well, and look, one last bit of data whilst we're on the topic, though, was the amount of negative equity. So around the same context.
Ooh, okay. Yeah,
so it is on the rise in all states other than, I believe, other than Queensland.
Right.
Mm. So, I mean, it's not growing a lot, but it is on the rise from where it was 12 months ago. So, of course, that you would assume with a lot of buyers that would have bought 12, 18 months ago, and a lot of the time first home buyers or sometimes, you know, investors without a lot of capital to put down are getting high LVRs. They're borrowing at 90%.
Yeah.
So if the property market has declined or the values in the area they've bought have declined that 8%, maybe 10%, chances are their property is worth less than what they paid and therefore less than what the loan they've got.
Especially if they've already paid 4 or 5% stamp duty as well.
Yeah, by the time you look at your total outlay to own, if the values have pulled back a little bit, you could be underwater according to where you're at. So that's where I think it's critical that if you're going to invest in property, make sure that you're not putting yourself under too much pressure because then you'll be forced to sell and that's a loss-making venture.
Yeah,
exactly. Mm. Well, thank you, Brett. Great to hear what you've been seeing in the news and in the property markets for the last week. Thank you, Brett.
Okay.
We'll take another break and we'll be back with my opinion next.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657-7640. Or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Welcome back, guys. And now let's hear from the star of our show. Louis, what have you got to say today?
Thank you. I am the star today, aren't I?
Yeah, very much.
Fantastic. So. Well, I'm usually the star every day of my life. So
just ask me.
That's right. Just ask. So what I wanted to talk about was something in personal finance I come across a lot is people who have not yet been active in investing. They don't own property. They don't own share portfolios. They're not active with their superannuation, not doing much with their personal finance. And the question comes up, well, why haven't you invested yet? And they're like, well, I'm not really sure the right time to invest. Or more importantly, I've got some reasons why I don't want to be invested or haven't invested yet. So I'm thinking, what are the barriers, what are the excuses that typically stop people from becoming an investor or becoming active with their long-term financial future? Mm. So when I'm having these conversations with people, I typically get a few common misconceptions of reasons why they haven't done anything yet. Probably the biggest one that concerns me, which is most factually incorrect, is where people want to pay off their home loan in full before they start investing.
Yeah. Particularly now.
So, in a low interest rate environment, we're talking?
Mm-hmm. In a low interest rate environment, but the concept has held for years and years. Since interest rates were really high, like 18% high, but even in that period of time, it coincided with financial markets getting major returns, not at exactly the same time, but around in that time frame. Mm-hmm. The thing is, if a person pays off their home loan in full, and let's say they take 20 years to pay off their home loan, and they do manage to pay it off early. So if someone gets their home loan when they're, say, 30 years old, and then pays it off by the time they're 50, which is pretty unlikely because, you know, between having 30 and 40, most people have a young family. Mm. Yeah. But if they do manage to pay it off by 50 or 55, then they start investing. They've only got a 10 to 15 year window of time to accumulate all their retirement savings.
Yeah.
And what they're doing is they're not giving their investments as much time as they could to earn growth and income returns, which are reinvested.
And compound.
And compound.
Well, paying, you know, the concept of paying down debt at high levels of interest rates makes sense. But if that's all you're doing and you're not taking some of that equity to then reinvest back into something else, then you're going to find yourself in some real trouble because all you're doing is just paying down a consumable item.
Yep.
And you're not going to end up with any capital at the end of the day other than the house that you live in.
Yep. That's right.
You've got to be doing more than that.
Yep. Mm. And just as a quick example of how the numbers work out, which demonstrates how factually incorrect it is, I did a simple calculation on 10 years worth of a theoretical example. Let's say someone has $500 a month that they could put into extra home loan repayments versus putting it into salary sacrifice to super.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh, huge.
And when it goes into super, I've used a rate of return of 10%, which is the average share market return over the last 100 years,
okay,
which is what Joel always tells us.
Yep.
So for that $500 per month, if they put it into their home loan through additional repayments, yes, their home loan would be $75,000 better off over 10 years,
yep,
which is nice. That's good, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if they had salary sacrificed it to superannuation, they would be $142,000 better off in their super fund.
That's quite a bit of difference.
It's about double.
Yeah.
So if you are not investing, if you're just paying off your home loan, well, you could be wasting half of your money.
You probably are wasting, almost certainly wasting.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Most certainly. Yeah. It's just the way the numbers work.
Yeah.
It's just the factual information and the system that we work in. It's not necessarily super contributions either. The investment strategy could be something different, something that's still achieves capital growth, mm-hmm. earns an income return, and is tax efficient in some way. So the actual strategy, I've used super as an example, but then when you project it over 20 years, the numbers get even bigger. So home loan, obviously there's more time for the interest to compound, but the same applies to super. There's more time for the interest to compound. And the difference is not just double the difference, it's three or four times the difference because of that compounding impact. So when you talk about over a 20 or 30 year working life from the age of 30 to 60, you're talking about, it's almost like you're retiring twice.
Yeah,
yeah.
You can retire twice.
Yeah, you're leaving too much money on the table.
That's right. Yep. Versus retiring just the once.
Yep.
In fact, the reality is you probably won't retire at age 60 if you just pay off your home loan and don't invest until your later years.
Yeah.
So you have to have your investment strategy now. So that's a common misconception, which is just wrong, and there needs to be the information to give people permission to invest instead of paying off their home loan first.
Louis, can I just add, there's two numbers that stick in my mind around that concept, is that if you're paying down your home loan, typically at the moment your mortgage rates are around 4%.
That's right.
And if the long-term stock market returns 10%, it's like, well, if I've got this money at 4% and I can achieve 10% with it, aren't I better off to use it in that market?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But that comes to the next couple of points.
Okay.
So people don't always have 100% confidence in their personal finance. And that's fair enough. And we put in place programs for people so that they can get their finances into a position where they do have 100% confidence that they can commit to an investment strategy.
Yeah.
And for some people, that's just a matter of helping them get their house in order. That might take a month, but it takes a bit of expertise to actually make it happen. If you've never got your financial house in order before, well, then how are you going to do it now, and how are you going to be confident that that you're ready?
Mm-hmm.
So you need to be proactive in getting the information by either engaging an expert or reading some books or talking to other people who have done it before in order to get the 100% confidence. Now, even 100% confidence doesn't mean 100% certainty.
No, there's nothing in this world that is ever certain.
Because if you're uncertain about your job, if you're uncertain about where you're going to be living, if you might change your house, if you're uncertain about your family situation, you might have another child or a child starting school. If you're uncertain about these things, you just need a plan in case those things happen.
Yeah.
So you don't need your life to be perfect. You just need to have certain plans in place, and including contingency plans, risk management. If something happens to my health, do I have insurance cover in place to make sure my income continues?
Mm. Yep.
So getting 100% confidence, again, there's a bit of a process of making sure those things are covered. Some people then say, well, I don't really know what I'm doing when it comes to choosing an investment.
Yeah.
Well, fair enough. Where can you get the knowledge? Same thing. You can engage an expert. You can read books or get the knowledge from learning it from somewhere. Or you can talk to people that have done it before.
Yep.
Choose one.
Most definitely.
Yeah, do it.
Yeah.
Get it done.
Don't think, just do.
That's right.
Don't
because
think.
It's life-changing. It's not life-changing today, but it will be extremely life-changing when you are in your later years.
Yeah. You just got to put the excuses aside and just take some action.
Yep, that's right. And then the last excuse I come up with is, well, the market doesn't seem good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, if you're not an expert investor and you're hearing that the market is not good, I'm just guessing that you're hearing it from The Age or The Herald Sun or The Morning Herald or
Courier Today Mail. Show.
Billion wiped off shares.
That's right. So if you're listening to them, that information, if it is correct information, that information is already priced into the market.
Yeah.
So if it is truly an uncertain time, that uncertainty has already resulted in the market being discounted. So you're buying your investment at fair value.
Mm.
But there's also a good chance that that information is actually just noise, not true information. So again, it pays to get proper research from expert investors, which you can typically you have to pay for it, because free information is usually worth what you pay for it.
Yes.
Or it costs you. You can engage an expert to who does have the knowledge.
Mm.
So if you are uncertain, it's only because of the sources of information that you're getting your news from.
Yeah.
And that's what I'd say there. Yeah. Guys, would you have any other reasons that you come up with?
Mindset's always a tough one.
Yeah.
Just dysfunctionality around money, which we've all got to some degree.
Yep. Mm. Yep.
Yeah, most definitely. No, Louis, I think you've hit it all on the head. No doubt about that.
Mm.
Well, I'm pretty awesome.
Star of our show.
I happen to know what I'm doing when it comes to these things.
Very good.
That's right. Been doing it for a while. So that's my two cents.
Well, Louis, just on that note, if you are a new investor and you are thinking about ways to go about making your first investment, particularly in the stock market or in any investment, new research from Credit Suisse has suggested that you should focus on founder and family-led businesses. Okay, so
what does that mean?
So what I mean by that is focus on those businesses where the founder and the family of the founder continue to own and control a large chunk of the shares. Usually, the research focused in on those companies that were listed companies in excess of $250 million around the globe, $250 million US around the globe that owned more than 20% of the market capitalization of the company. What they found was that those founder and family-run businesses significantly outperform companies that are not, that are generally a much more of a corporation that have a board that only have CEOs.
And hire and fire
hire
people.
Hire and fire, exactly.
Yeah. Right.
So wow. what they found was that across the 1,015 companies that they surveyed around the world, more than half of them were based out of Asia. And these companies can include, think about companies like Alphabet, or Google, Alibaba, Facebook, Berkshire Hathaway, Samsung Electronics, Walmart, LVMH, L'Oreal.
And in Australia, the commonly known Westfields.
Westfield. Corporate Travel Management.
Fortescue Mining.
Fortescue Mining. What's some other? Flight Centre. Mm. JB Hi-Fi.
Is that right?
Not JB Hi-Fi, sorry. Harvey Norman. Yep. So these companies have traditionally produced significantly greater returns. Since 2016, in fact, the returns have been... Almost double the returns of non-family-led companies over the past 12 years. Now, they also suggest that there's been a lot of concern as well around whether or not companies who are family-led, often these companies could have different classes of shares, where the control and the voting power stays with the family, even though the share ownership is a much smaller minority.
News Corp,
Alphabet, Facebook, they're all typical examples of these types of businesses. It's more prolific in the United States than what it is in most other areas around the world. But what they also found was that those companies outperform family-led companies that have shareholdings more in alignment with ordinary shareholders. And the rationale perhaps behind that is that because the family is in control, the family is thinking longer term because they're thinking of generational succession.
Yeah. Mm.
So they're making decisions more on capital expenditures, long-term investments back into the business.
Mm-hmm. Not looking for short-term wins.
Not looking for short-term wins, whereas where the family owns shares on the same basis as ordinary shareholders, they have less control, less voting power. They're more influenced by doing things like share buybacks, which are much more short-term focused. So just an interesting note, if you are thinking about actually taking action and moving forward with your investments, focus on those companies that have a significant proportion of family-led and family-owned businesses.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So if there is a company that's that listing, like if Facebook had listed with Mark Zuckerberg saying, no, I'm selling everything and I'm stepping down, probably a bad sign.
Yeah.
But the fact that he's still there, he could be viewed as a controversial figure, depending on your opinion. But the fact that he's there is showing the ongoing leadership.
Yeah, and these businesses tend to be much more entrepreneurially minded as well. So, I mean, you have a look at Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, he's created the most phenomenal religion, almost. I mean, he's created something that's bigger than all of the major religions.
Yep.
2 billion active monthly users. Yeah. Mm. I'm sure that Catholicism and Christianity and Islam don't have those sorts of numbers. And certainly... you know, what he's achieved since he started it in, what, like 12 years or something like that?
Yep.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's taken, you know, centuries and millenniums for those religions to get to the numbers and followers that they've got. Now,
and I think there's something to be said when there is one person at the top and when they say something, it happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are checks and balances in place, but if there's one extremely strong voice that covers the whole thing, think of Facebook. Google's probably a bit more spread because there's multiple founders there.
Yep.
But Berkshire Hathaway with Warren Buffett.
Yep.
Fortescue Mining with Twiggy Forrest. Yep. His control has been diluted and regulatory pressure means he's stepped down from certain things. But it's still what that one person says is what happens.
Yeah, they're much more nimble, able to take action. Now,
correct.
That coincides also nicely with a Citigroup global bear market checklist. So just a very quick note, we obviously check in on what's going on in the stock markets. The volatility still is present today.
So this is where the red lights are flashing on the global economy.
Yep, and Citigroup have released their global bear market checklist. And in actual fact, since the peak in September a couple of months ago, the checklist has gone from 4 out of 18 down to 3 out of 18, suggesting that the chances of a major bear market still remain extraordinarily low.
Wow.
Going forward. So perhaps if you are thinking about taking some action today and making your first set of investments, focus on those companies that have a significant family-led and family-controlled share structure. And perhaps now is a pretty good time to actually start taking that action.
Yep. Getting in.
Brett, what's a good way for people to get in touch?
Easiest way, through our podcast, go to our website, which is theinvestorexchange.com.au, and enter your message, either type it in or via voice, and we'll get back to you. Or even if it's a good question, we might even discuss it on air.
You mean the experts on this panel are available for people to make queries?
Well, especially you, Lee.
Private consultations?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow, you can't be serious.
Well, that must lead us to another part of our show.
For our favourite part of the show, what's been happening in the world?
Well, two marine pilots, this is, you're going to love this one. Two marine pilots out of Southern California have been sanctioned or disciplined for making a flight path over the skies of Southern California in the shape of a penis. Now, they first aroused controversy.
Oh, nice journalism.
when the flight path showed up on radar, and by all means, they actually did a pretty good job. That's a nice curvature. No, come on.
Jeez.
Did it look familiar?
All the way from San Diego up to Los Angeles.
Around good the phallic islands symbol. And back. Never goes astray, does it?
No, down over the... Right. Over Tijuana, yeah, and then looping back to Rosarito,
yeah,
one lower than the other.
Brett, you got something to get us out of the gutter?
Yeah, let's move on. So today, I mean, we're based in Melbourne, and it's going to be close to 40 degrees here today, which is crazy.
Whoa.
It's the first, well, second really hot one of our summer. And I saw something the other day that's a mile away from that, but I thought it's really archaic that it's actually illegal to have snowball fights in Severance.
You cannot be serious.
So Severance is a small 3,000-strong community in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains in Colorado.
Right.
And they have a 100-year-old law saying it's illegal to have snowball fights.
Yeah. Give me a break.
Crazy. But it's changed. A 9-year-old who heard about it thought, this is crazy, I need to do something. Apparently it was such a big issue that the mayor used to always mention the ban anytime school children would take tours of his office. It was a real speaking point. So one young 9-year-old took it to task and has been able to have the ban lifted.
Oh, good on him. Good.
Very good.
And here's something people anyone power. With siblings would appreciate for him too. After he was successful, he was asked, where is he going to throw his first snowball? And he pointed at his little sister.
Good on you, buddy.
Good on him. Thank you, listeners, for joining us for another episode. We hope you enjoyed today's content, and we'll be back again next week. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you, Louis.
Thank you, Joel.
Bye.
Catch you all soon.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au and follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalized, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.